Shrink Wrap Radio number 758, Psychotherapy as a Performing Art, with Mark O'Connell and Robin Weigert.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are Mark O'Connell, LCSW, New York City therapist, actor, and author of The Performing Art of Therapy, and his friend, actor Robin Weigert, who, among her film credits, is her role as the psychotherapist in the TV series Big Little Lies. In real life, Robin comes from a family of noted psychoanalysts. Now, here's the interview. Mark O'Connell and Robin Weigert, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. I have to say I am a fan of your show, and it's a real pleasure to be here with you and Robin.
Okay. Well, it's a real pleasure for me. And of course, you wrote a very winning note to me, letting me know that you were a fan and that you would like to be a guest. And your note was so winning. I get a fair number of those. They're not all winners, but you were a winner. So... Yeah, and I feel like a winner to have you too on the show, I can tell you. And I'm wondering how you two met. You're both actors, I know that, but how did you meet?
You just platformed how we met really well, because Mark wrote a very winning note to me. And I also don't usually respond to, you know, those things. But yeah. He so intrigued me, because he was in the middle of writing a book called The Performing Art of Psychotherapy, and had responded to a character I was playing at the time, a psychotherapist on a show called Big Little Lies. And yeah. and we started a dialogue as he was writing his book about, I guess, the intersection of our two professions. And actually, Mark used to be an actor, so he knew a great deal coming in as well. And we had a great deal to say to each other, as it turned out. My father was a psychoanalyst, and I always wished for my dad that he had been able to see what he did as a creative art. I thought that would be something that would be psychologically beneficial for him, let's just say. If he could understand that what he did was gloriously creative, the creative act that is acting and the creative act that is being a psychotherapist share in common the art of listening. And so that was a lot of what Mark and I started to talk about, is this extraordinary thing of listening and yeah. being able to place the other person in a truthful space through your listening. And then you, as an actor, also bring yourself into a truthful space through your listening. So it was a really fruitful and wonderful conversation, and I'm so glad that he wrote such a wonderful note.
Yeah, he did. And your input, I think, certainly appears in the book, and the book is so wonderfully written. So you both have experience as actors, and Mark, you're a psychotherapist. Robin, you're not. But I'm wondering, were you ever on the receiving end of psychotherapy? I assume that Mark was in his training.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, so that probably helped in the role that you played in Big Little Lies, which I'm a big fan of of Big Little Lies, and went back to rewatch some of the scenes that you were in there. And I recommend that to all of our listeners and viewers out there. So, Mark, in your book, you write about what's been called a third in the psychoanalytic literature. And I want to jump right into the deep end of the pool here by sharing with you two my sense of a third that I feel is already with us, namely synchronicity. I don't normally do these shows thematically, you know, a series of shows on a theme. But as I look back, I'm struck by this show seems thematically related to the two that came before it. Maybe it's just me, but later you can take a look and see what you think. They both involved a dive into narrative and story. So, Mark, am I stretching the concept of a third too far to bring in synchronicity?
Oh, not at all. Absolutely. Robin recognized when I sent her a bit of my introduction originally, she recognized that I was writing about Jessica Benjamin, and I was trying to do it in a way that was accessible to really anyone. And she recognized that I hadn't used her concept of the third. And we started talking about the third. I recognized that there was a third kind of space opening up between Robin and I as well.
Sure, yeah.
And that's when I got really excited about sort of talking with her and dialoguing and collaborating, because the thing itself that I was trying to write about was happening in the way that we were communicating.
Yeah.
Including, and when you talk about synchronicity, I was even aware at that time, Robin uses the word invitation a lot with your scene partner. And I was thinking a lot about how when you're inviting a kind of recognition between people, it actually, who knows how to explain it, but something enters that's bigger than both of you. And it's almost mystical. And I was having that experience when I was talking with Robin, including learning about her grandmother, who was also a psychoanalyst, a formidable psychoanalyst. And I started reading her, and she's Edith Weigert. She's incredibly contemporary, actually. It feels fresh. The writing, she calls psychotherapy an art in her writing, and talks about the need for the therapist to be flexible, the way an actor needs to be flexible and really join the person who's in front of you. So it's not at all a stretch to think of the third as, you know, in terms of synchronicity and all the possibilities for connection.
Yeah, and when these interviews go really well, sometimes I have that sense as well, you know, that there's a real connection that somehow goes beyond screens, and that's always a wonderful experience. Well, Robin's already given a good introduction, I think, to your book, Mark, which by the way, I think is fabulous, very well written and constructed, very well argued. In the book, you convincingly argue that therapy can be seen as a performance. So let me invite you to hit some of the highlights of that concept.
Yes, and I think that can sound a little deceptive. I don't mean when I use that word at all that it should be fake, or that there is fakery in it. It's the opposite. I'm actually talking about real acting, which is I think we all actually know intuitively that good acting is truthfulness, that the person is finding different perspectives and contexts in themselves. And that's when we respond to good acting. And so that's how I think of good therapy, is when the roles that I'm being cast in as for this individual who's in front of me, finding those rather than trying to disavow something that feels uncomfortable or foreign to me, really leaning into it and recognizing, okay, for one thing, this is someone from this person's past, or a kind of role that they're used to in their life. But it's also a part of me. It may be a part of me I don't like, but it's human, and it's necessary to lean into it to understand this person better. And so relational psychotherapists in particular would talk about that in terms of transference and countertransference. But I think before we even get to theory, much like acting, before you get to theory and technique, you're thinking about leading with yourself. mm-hmm. and your individual idiosyncratic being that you bring into the room. And that is where you start. And the goal is very simple. You're trying to make a specific human being be as alive as possible. And the means to achieve that goal are the same in therapy and in acting, which is at least two people need to exchange attention. That's it.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts. And that's where the magic happens.
Just to, I'm going to piggyback on that. I didn't listen to the one prior to that, but I listened to the one that aired prior to this one, when this one will, your last one. And I'm very interested in that space, the difference between, or perhaps the overlap between what is being created and what is being unearthed. And there's actually, it's a grayer area than we might think. So that this business of character, when a character is being revealed or when a patient is being revealed, they're also partly being created. And I suppose it's most obvious with a character that there is a creative act going on. But the way in which the patient, the analysis and whatever, is being unearthed, it is partly a creative act, a co-creative act. The story, which was last week's theme, that is attached to, that the patient begins to attach to him or herself, you know, it is part of how the self is constructed. And that story isn't a given. That story can be rewritten. That story right. can be yeah. examined and turned over. And
yeah.
So this is a huge area of overlap, because what might not be intuitive to somebody who doesn't act is that a lot of what is happening when you're creating a character is that you're discovering the character. You have a set of discrete experiences. It affects your body and your, you know, psyche, whatever, in certain ways. And the character begins to come out of you. And you can simply observe, ah, there it is, as opposed to, like, I sat down and manufactured that. There is a synchronicity, to use your word, or a kind of a kismet about
that process. You begin to feel inhabited by the character, right? Almost like a ghost possession. You know, one of the things that really struck me in the book is when you talk about I'm going to say Mark, I don't know, but you have so much influence on the book as well, Robin, so it may apply equally. I don't know. But the section where you talk about how to express this, that the actors, talking about drama now, the actors are persons with their own individual lives and characters and so on, and that effective actors, as a member of the audience, I'm not interested in them as people, and I'm totally sucked into this performance that they're doing. And I never thought about it that way, you know, before reading this. It really brought that home that, and you talk about a sort of going off script, which applies. I see how that applies in psychotherapy, that we can be too married to our theory of what we're supposed to do rather than be fully in the moment. So I see that part. How in acting do you go off script?
Well,
if it's not absolute improvisation of making up the lines.
I mean, this gets to something that's very near to my heart, which is the idea that there's a sort of sacerdotal function of the actor, which I think is lost today, a bit. You know, we think of actors as sort of, you know, performers, they're entertaining, we like them, they're celebrities, they're stars. But we miss the fact that what acting is for is that it serves a societal purpose, and that it has to do with empathy, and it has to do with something, you know, communicated through the actor being open to receive the character that then also opens the audience to their own potential. And it's an offering, or it should be an offering, a sort of gift of empathy. And so I think that within that idea of what acting is and is for, I like to leave a great deal of space for the unexpected to happen. I like to leave a great deal of space to not know for not knowing exactly how I'm going to play a set of beats that stand before me. You know, I don't have a map necessarily. I want to be listening and I want to be receiving. And that's not just to what the other person is saying, but that's also what's to what's coming into me and through me. You know, David Milch, who wrote Deadwood, talks about the transmigration of souls. You know, he really takes it to the next level in terms of, you know, what may come into us. But I always want to be open for that possibility, that something is just going to infuse me, that I have absolutely no say over it. Yeah. And I just let it come through. It doesn't always happen, but I want to make a space where that could happen. And that's nothing to do with going off script, saying different words. It might, but it's much more to do with not having nailed down exactly how you want to do the scene. Right?
I would think maybe the tone of voice of the person opposite you might affect your choice of the tone of voice of how you say your line.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I'm so used to speaking with actors about acting that it's interesting to speak to someone who's a non-actor about acting.
I'm very naive about this.
Well, I just hear you talking about what we might call qualities, you know, and every acting teacher you have says, let's not talk about qualities, let's talk about intentions. You know, people who don't act are going to be thinking like, wow, when she colored her voice that way, it really had thus and such an effect. If I were thinking, how am I going to color my voice so that I have this effect? It would be dead in the water. It's what we're pursuing that's actually motoring the scenes, right? Mark, you can speak to this as well because you've been an actor. It's what we're pursuing. It's what we're sort of after, I guess you'd say, right? So that's going to inform the tone of my voice as it does in real life. It's gonna, but if I sit around manufacturing tones of voice, I might be in some trouble. I mean, there probably are performers who do that, but I think I'd be in some trouble in terms of you believing me.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't want to be seeking a result. I think that's what have in common. I mean, awareness. I talk a lot in the book about you want to have an awareness. You don't want to be self-conscious where you're trying to produce something vocally or in any other way, but just an awareness of how this thing works and the different ways that you can use yourself in the present moment to reach, you know, the other person. And actually this is a really interesting subject for me in terms of just the idea of how you see the script that we have scripts as well in therapy. You know, a supervisor might tell us, oh, just say this to the client. In fact, lots of the writing, the interventions in the writing that say, you know, oh, I figured it out. And this is what I said. It's always about the script. It's not, we don't get to know how it was delivered, which it makes a world of difference. You know, how you were, what you were feeling, how you were responding to the person in that moment, what the action was that you were playing, and how you were using your body, where your energy was placed.
Yeah. So you're talking about when we read a case history and it's just there on the page, but we don't know how it was embodied. Yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. And I wanted so one of the things I wanted to do with the book is just make it a complement to, you know, any kind of theory or modality, any kind of writing on therapy. I just wanted it to complement and really think about, well, how did you say the line? What actually happened moment to moment and holistically with your whole institution?
Yeah. So you're saying in the book, you make a strong point of you don't have to throw away whatever theory you're married to or you've been practicing.
Not at all.
But and we all know that we're supposed to have presence. I mean, we've heard this, we've seen the research that it's the person of the psychotherapist more than anything else is going to be that person and how they're experienced by the client that will lead to whatever effectiveness there is there. And yet you give us a new way to think about presence, and you break down a lot of by drawing on your acting experience, you break down a lot of the elements that might go into presence. I think I have some experience, I'm not sure where or when or how, of somebody who had acting training saying something to me. Maybe it was in a skit or something in camp. I don't know. But it was like, it was so powerful that I kind of froze in the face of it, not having had that acting training. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you ever had that experience?
I think I might know what you're talking about, but I try to be careful in the book to say that I'm not trying to offer you a way to be Judi Dench as a means of, you know, performing therapy better at all. I offer all of those exercises, voice, body, energy, as a means of staying present with this, like, what, you know, your mind, your body, your context, your imagination. If those things help you to holistically, you know, connect in the present, you know, because what you're really practicing is being present. And if those techniques are alienating someone, that's something you want to, you know, you don't want to do that. You want to, you know, so that's why I say I am encouraging therapists to think like actors, because professional actors know that the main goal is to find the truth, find the connection. And then if the techniques help to facilitate that, great. And if they don't, and if they're deadening the whole experience, then okay, we're going to try something else. Mm-hmm. But therapists don't necessarily think that way. And that's part of what I wanted to mm-hmm. introduce, is that, or just encourage more of, whatever you're using, use it as a practice of staying present, really in your life and in your work.
Which came first for you, Mark, acting or therapy?
Listening, which I think is just the same thing. I really, the answer that I always give to people is it's just like life's work. And it began with just being a listener from a very early age and everything that meant.
Mark is a wonderful parent. I've had a chance, you know, getting to be his friend in the wake of this, to watch him with his child. And I think of good parenting as an act of listening the child into his or her own becoming. There's a course that the child is on. And if you listen well, you nurture them on that course. You're not telling the child who to be, or you're somehow violating the child. You know, you're trying to listen them into their own process of becoming. And I think that is also what you're doing for a character, and that's also what you're doing for a patient. So that's a real tie-in, you know, this creative act of listening.
Yeah.
And my grandmother's collected book of essays was called The Courage to Love, which I think is a wonderful title under which all these, you know, essays were published. It's allowing there to be your practice and your methodology, and in the case of what Mark is also helping us understand, an awareness of how we come across, all of that, plus, you know, all of that in addition to making a space where something resembling love is possible to enter, to join in this mm-hmm. kind of creative act that you're about. Mm-hmm. So that seems critical to me.
Yeah. I watched the YouTube of the that you did for the Psychotherapy Networker, in which you disclosed that you have a child, and that you sounded like you were pretty new to parenting at that point, and you were very excited about it.
Very new.
So how old is it, a boy, a girl? What?
He's a boy, uh-huh. and he shares his name with Robin. His name's Robin.
Is there a connection? Does Robin get
synchronicity again?
Wow. Okay.
He came about during this time I was working on the book, and it was just one of those, another example of that. But he's going to be three.
And oh, that's a delightful age.
Well, it is an age that helps me understand. Not understand, but practice how to work with disappointed and enraged clients.
Uh-huh. Okay. A very expressive child.
Yeah. I mean, he's also very, you know, it's three. So he's very sweet and very perceptive and very relational one moment, and then, you know, turns on a dime. Yeah. But it really helps me accept my kind of imperfect responses, you know, to that kind of inconsolable sort of fury that a person can get into. And it really has helped me a great deal in the kind of improvisations with clients when you're trying to help set boundaries in a loving way. And there really isn't a way to do that without kind of going through the scene moment to moment, being imperfect, apologizing a great deal. So it's helped me.
I'll put a link to that video in the show notes. I encourage people to go ahead and watch that, because it you really present a kind of case history there of your learning in terms of learning how to deal with his emotionality and how to handle your own, I guess. And it, and you bridge that to psychotherapy as well. Yeah. So I found that to be delightful. By the way, I'm a parent of four now grown adults, two of whom were twins, and seven grandchildren. So I know what you're talking about. Maybe not about acting so much, but, I always felt like I would be a good actor. It just didn't come about.
Well, and doing podcasts, you're doing something akin to acting, aren't you?
I think so. I can own that. And but talking to you two, I realize I'm really going to have to up my game in terms of expressiveness. I can sometimes just kind of be kind of flat. So it's wonderful to have this opportunity to exercise that. So what haven't we touched on yet? I'm sure there's a lot that we haven't really dived into here.
Well, one thing I want to address is that, or just emphasize is that I really want people to think when we're talking. I'm not introducing a new novel way to do therapy. It's not a new modality or technique or anything. It's not an EFT, CBT, LMNOP. It's not a new certification with letters. It is really what therapy has always been and what we actually do in the room. So I just want to emphasize that, because I think a lot of us don't talk about what we actually do. Doing is using ourselves and figuring out what works best in this relationship. But somehow we don't necessarily talk about that. And so thinking like an actor, when you think that way, it just first and foremost gets you back to the core goal of the whole thing. That's what, during the pandemic, having to go virtual, having patients hearing my son screaming in the other room, bizarre things happening, moving the computer to the basement, having to put on a Halloween costume because I was cold, dealing with all of the things going wrong, you remind yourself, I'm not lost. The goal is to connect with this person and to use whatever I can to make them feel heard, recognized, and alive in this moment.
Yeah.
And that's actually something I've just been rereading, a paper that Robin's grandmother wrote on creativity. And she's talking about working in a time of crisis as well. She talks about working with Nazi occupation in Berlin. And she talks about one day of work where someone comes in who's a Nazi sympathizer. The next person is someone who's Jewish who has to escape. The next person is Marxist and is concerned about how she's going to be receiving this person. She's like, what technique am I supposed to be using? And yet, even in this moment of global existential crisis, she finds a way to connect with the people and provide the service. There's a way to provide the service even if the world is blowing up.
Well,
really.
Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, it's interesting that if civilization itself is mad, which seems to be the case, then it sort of, it becomes an inverted equation, doesn't it? It's not necessarily the good doctor isn't necessarily working to say how do you get in lockstep with what society demands of you. It's more how do you navigate a course where you have a chance of selfhood in the face of all of these pressures. And boy, that time in her life must have demanded so much empathy from my grandmother.
And it's so counter to the stereotype that is out there about psychoanalysts and psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not rote, it's not following a script, but it's really right. being there and listening to that person. I'm going to cough. Excuse me.
That's the other thing I wanted to address, actually, because with psychoanalysis, the classic idea of a blank screen, as if right. that's possible, is incredibly unhelpful. Continues to pervade the work of so many people when we're told to just give space to people. That's not something that you do with your absence. In fact, you can't be absent. You are there no matter what. So they're experiencing you, whatever you're doing. You create space for someone, even if you're perfectly still and silent, you create that with your presence. And that's the other main thing I always want to emphasize for people. I do it in my webinars. We talk a lot about film performances, actors playing therapists, but really just how much is possible when you're just being quiet and actually actively listening to the person. It's an action, and it's a practice to stay that present. And actually, no one is going to believe me, but one of my clients actually thanked me recently and recognized that this person is a teacher, and they recognized that I was present with them even when he was like, in the beginning of the treatment, he was kind of like, I wanted more from you. I was kind of, I felt lost. I felt like something more should be happening. I was frustrated. He was like, but now I'm gradually appreciating that you're there. And he used the word brave, even though I rarely speak in sessions.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not anyone's idea of classic psychoanalysis. He understands that I'm there with him and values that. So I thought that was.
So I'm struck to hear you say that you rarely speak in session, because in the video that I saw, you're very expressive, kind of flamboyant, right? And I hope that's not too big a surprise. but you're really, I guess, making space for them and putting that in the back.
Yeah, and it really depends. The practice is to be present more than anything. And so you give the scene what it needs. You give the person what they need, and you figure that out as you go. Some clients, you recognize that you try, you think they want some advice or something, or more of you talking, and then you see them flinching, and you're like, okay, that's frustrating for them. And you learn to sit back and kind of follow their lead, and that kind of adjustment is, I find, really exciting when you figure out, actually, it's going to be really helpful for me to give more of myself for less of myself. It's really exciting because you are being very genuine, but you're kind of playing a character too. And most exciting of all is you're pulling forth a version of this person that they're not comfortable inhabiting, but they need to inhabit.
Yeah.
So I want to comment here, because one of the reasons that I got so engaged with Mark is he has so much joy. And you can hear that in the way he's talking now. And you know, psychotherapists, I grew up around a lot of them because my father was one, his mother was one. All his colleagues were around and about when I was growing up. And I noticed there were a lot of depressives, a lot of depressed people who did not give themselves credit for much, actually. And my dad had taken over his mother's creativity series. And there was this series at the Washington Psychoanalytic Institute, which he was the president of, that where they would bring in creative luminaries from wherever. You know, Anais Nin traipsed through our house at one point when I was a child. Gary Gygax, who invented Dungeons and Dragons, and whoever might be sort of interesting for them to study. What is it to be creative? And I always thought, even as a very young child, like there's a fallacy here. You know, you are creative. My dad would listen to classical music and weep at the Bach and Mozart and Beethoven. You know, how did they do it? You know what? Yeah. And psychotherapists in general, it seemed to me then, maybe different today, seemed to fall into this sort of cloud of my function is here in the shadows, and I observe, and I help the other people to realize themselves. And and why I wanted to join in with Mark in his endeavor was to say, no, there can be tremendous creative joy in what you are doing. There can be, you know, it is an art form. Yes. You know, like kind of wanting to do a clarion call to all the psychotherapists out there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be so sad. It really can be a joyful practice, even if you're seeing people in tremendous pain and trouble, you know, which is part of the deal. You know, you are doing something phenomenally creative. And I feel like Mark is a great example of that. So,
thank you for saying that.
I think maybe you guys are on the vanguard or some kind of a cutting edge, maybe, of helping to get this message across. And I think back to when I was in graduate school in a psychoanalytically oriented at the University of Michigan program. And yeah, the faculty did look sad. I was alienated by it. I didn't find anybody that I was aspiring to be like them, which made it very difficult. Mm-hmm. And it did feel like, you know, and reading books like by these Finichel and other very technically oriented psychoanalytic writers, you know, where it was all about technique and nothing about heart, soul, joy, creativity, etc.
The only thing that got it all out, it's about the human condition. It's really astounding to me that we kind of missed that. The practice, it's a practice of integrating the full self. And when you think in terms of an actor, I think that's part of what makes it fun for me. Because actors talk about, actors have so much more fun playing real life people, for example, than those people had living their lives. You know, they talk about, Daniel Day-Lewis will talk about the joy of playing Lincoln, or, you know, or Meryl Streep will talk about, Julia Child or whoever. Or someone who's really difficult, let's say, and they'll say, oh, she's so difficult, but they have so much joy trying to understand her from the inside out. And we can do that with our clients and with ourselves. And ultimately, I hope to encourage my clients. I want my clients to be thinking of themselves the way an actor talks about a character in an interview, where they're like, oh, she's going through a really tough time. She was experiencing this trauma, but having this kind of maybe even like creative energy, exuberance, as they piece together their own life.
Yeah.
And it really is the actors make such a great contribution. Actors like Robin in particular make a contribution. The actors who get to play so many different kinds of people and to embody so many different aspects of humanity. You know, it's a contribution.
Robin, you played so many roles. I was looking through the filmography on IMDb and it was like shocking. And then, you know, in Lies and, I'm blocking on the name of Big Little Lies. You know, you're playing against or performing with, you know, these world-class actors. Reese Witherspoon and Meryl Streep.
You're talking about A-listers, yes.
Yeah, yes. So how do you not
– yeah.
Did you have any problem with feeling intimidated, or, you know, did you have to work with yourself in any way to get through that?
I don't suffer from that. If anything, I have a lot of empathy for the pressure that it puts on an actor to be a celebrity of that stature. It's a very unnatural way to go through life. You know, you can't walk down the street without being stared at, and there's a new, relatively new compared to the others, disease in the DSM-5 called acquired situational narcissism, which you look it up, and it is not the narcissism that comes from, I imagine everybody in the world is looking at me and thinking about me. It's what comes from actually experiencing that on a daily basis. Acquired situational narcissism.
Yeah.
Very hard to dodge when you are an A-list celebrity, because everybody's giving you a super unnatural level of attention. I actually think it's sort of an affliction, although the paycheck more than makes up for it, because you can get a really good therapist, you know, a top drawer therapist to help you with that issue. But No, so I always see the pressure they're under. I have some, maybe some paycheck envy, but I don't, won't deny that. But I don't feel dwarfed by it. I feel, if anything, engaged by it, because I think it's a hardship. And more often than not, there's a wonderful, wonderful person in there, but needs to trust you, needs to feel trust to open up and be able to be present. And all they want to do is be present. It's the same thing for all actors, you know, and if you're able to come in and give that person an excuse to be present, you're really doing service both to the piece and to, you know.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Britney Spears a bit as you, as you talk about this acquired narcissism and the difficulty.
I'm not pointing that at anybody in particular.
Of her situation, you know, which really shines a spotlight on that, as well as many others that could be mentioned. Mark, I'm wondering, in your training, was there more encouragement to be yourself, to be spontaneous, to be in touch with your joy? Was a change in the philosophy reflected, or have you just come to this on your own?
Oh, no. In fact, it's going in the other direction, which I should note. I have friends who teach at social work schools, and even the big social work schools are all behavioral, evidence-based. The insurance companies are basically ruling social work programs. Take a psychodynamic, not even psychoanalysis, psychodynamic course at a social work program now is like taking like something in the dark arts or something.
Yeah.
It's a problem. To think in terms of long form and a person's history is like mystical or something. So, because I had gone to drama school and I had been to grad school twice, I was like, I really wanted to be very careful and independent in my, how I trained. And so I really just gravitated to the writing of, I chose my mentors based on the writing that I gravitate. So I chose people and not places, not institutions. And I think that really helped me have a very free sense of how to work. I think, you know, they're both apprentice professions, acting and therapy. You really learn from people in that connection with another person. So yes, I did, I suppose, but I chose my training very independently. Yeah.
What would you suggest to people who want to develop presence, who may recognize in themselves, well, I don't know if I'm that good a listener. Actually, I went so far as to decide to get training as a glider pilot because I knew that my attention wanders, you know? And I thought, okay, I'm going to put myself in this life and death situation where if I don't pay close attention, you know, I'm not going to make it. What do you recommend? I wouldn't recommend becoming a glider pilot.
I couldn't recommend anything better than that. I mean, that's incredible. Good for you. Really anything that's going to put you, I'm quoting Brené Brown now, but really put you in the arena so that even when, like my client was observing about me, even when you're listening quietly, you want to have the sense that you are being observed, that everything that you're bringing, even by default, is having an effect. It's just it's a practice. So anything that's going to help you practice recognizing yourself, even just on your own. I know this is a dicey thing, but videotaping yourself or watching yourself. I tell people in my webinars to just take a look at yourself while you're in session. And they think, well, I'm not going to be listening to the client. And actually, you might even be listening more deeply and ironically getting out of your way more if you get a sense of what this mask is that you're bringing and what you're doing automatically. Yeah. You might
So you're doing supervision in webinars?
I do workshops based on the book, and I do I'm doing one tonight, actually. I do with a company called CEU, so you can get CE credit if you're a social worker. And then I do at conferences around the country. So I've been at this networker symposium, and I hope to be back this coming year. And at the IARP, International Association of Relational Psychoanalysts and Psychotherapists, next year in LA. I'll be there too.
Good. So you're bringing this rather fresh voice with some energy into the field. That's good. What if people want to – well, it doesn't sound like just any odd person. They're all connected to particular organizations. You're not doing any sort of freestanding workshops?
No, not right.
I would encourage you to do that. I think that this should be, you know, I've got lots of psychotherapists or wannabe psychotherapists who are listeners and viewers of this interview, and I would think they would feel a little spark, you know, about, wow, I would like to develop these kinds of this kind of confidence about having presence.
Thank you. I will think about it as part of my reentry plan.
Yeah, really.
Well, I wanted to say something to you too. I'm very impressed that you tried to be a pilot to work on presence. It's really so cool. But and you were both talking about Brené Brown. I think part of presence is vulnerability, and this fake sort of tabula rasa idea of what a therapist is. One of the reasons that fails is there's just no vulnerability on the part of the therapist who's trying to be tabula rasa. It's what some maddening partners do in relationships, which is say, this is all about you, you know, and you know you're being gaslit when that's going. It's daring to be actually present means daring to be vulnerable. You know, the patient is bringing a lot of difficult material in that's no doubt triggering, and there are counter transference and transference issues that are going to come up, and you have to brave those waters, or you're unable to do any good from a position of safety.
Yeah.
And I would understand why over years and years you kind of recede into a safer and safer posture almost naturally, because it's very, very hard to absorb so much darkness. It really is. But again, if Mark has a significant contribution to make, I really think it is this, which is that if it's engaged with joy, it does not have to wear you down to the point where you become ossified and shut down within the therapeutic scenario. You know, you actually can engage with that sense of spark and joy, even a patient in the most acute pain, you know, the deepest crisis. Someone who clearly needs medication and is just bringing sorrow and misery into your office every single time, you can engage it with this curiosity and this interest that has to do in a way with character, I think, with let's mine this. Let's see what this wants to become. Let's get in there, you know. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't just have to be about fielding this pain and taking it on and taking it in if you're not protected from it, which is where you stop listening well. You know,
yeah. And it's necessary. It's necessary to lean into it and to use it. When in the chapter in my book on practicing being present, that's one of the first things I talk about is loss. It's you know, I make loss a daily part of my practice. So the joy or the energy kind of, you know, comes out as a side effect of actually just practicing being in all of it for me in my case. But I think that for everyone, I mean, I think it's by leaning into the pain and integrating it into your being, which is what actors do. Actors are always trying to cry and stuff like that. Actors are always talking, you know, I remember being a young actor and being like really forcing it. It took me, now that I'm in my 40s, I'm like, oh, it's there. The pain is just there.
Particularly during this pandemic, maybe we can talk about that a little bit more. Plenty of pain, plenty of pain coming to the fore in the pandemic. How have you dealt with that? How does that inform therapy?
Just struggling and trying to take my own advice. I found it harder to take my advice on being present. I realized it was really nice when you were able to have a babysitter and you're able to structure your life and everything was fine and I could go for my runs in the park with ease, that was easy to take my advice on how to stay present. I found it much more difficult, obviously, when your husband's in his board meeting and you're exchanging the child and, you know, all the things that everyone has been going through. But even still, it really has been about loss. And again, leaning into, okay, my body's different. I'm in pain in certain ways. My mental health has taken a hit because I can't go for my run and I can't talk to as many people. And I'm going to use that to help me to connect with each person. And I actually found it, I felt very lucky to be a therapist this past year, to be able to connect with so many different people and actually provide some space and to understand to a certain extent firsthand what many people were struggling with and normalizing it, because everyone was in their own little silo too. So that was part of the function of my role. So having that role, I think, helped me to survive that myself and to help people.
What would you say to people who are suffering during the pandemic? We thought that it was over. I know for myself, I've got serious questions about whether or not it's over or whether we're in for more of the same or even worse. Do some therapy on us.
I mean, we have to be you have to just try to center yourself in every moment. You don't want to play the end of the scene, as it were. You just have to be where we are. And we're not nearly out of the woods on this. I mean, especially those of us with kids, you know, our kids aren't vaccinated, or the young kids are not. And who knows? If we learned anything, is that we can be blindsided at any moment. Like, the rules kept changing with this. It was like a migraine.
I mean, I'm sorry, the question wasn't directed to me, but I do have a strong thought on this, which is that one of the diseases of the culture is that it's been in denial of death. Death is not an integrated concept at all in America. And we're not able to escape it with this. And all of the attendant opportunities for spiritual growth are there because we're forced to actually look it in the face. This denial of death, this modality that we're all in, has not been helpful to any of us, I don't think. You know, it's a running from, it's a suppressing, it's a, let's just put the elderly away someplace where we don't have to look at them. It's a very cruel culture in terms of healthcare and everything else, because we do not grapple in any way with death. And the pandemic does not let us get away with that. And I see a lot of people going through these extraordinary life changes. That sometimes it has to do with raising it all to the ground, you know, like, I'm just going to take the entire structure of my life and completely get rid of everything and start building again from scratch. But what they're building is stronger, truer, better, more integrated, more who they actually are. And I see this over and over and over again. So, yes, there's tremendous loss. It's very confronting, but it also might be a path towards greater health as a collective, you know, than what we came from before, God knows, you know. So just to try to look for the opportunity in it was, for me, the silver lining of this terrible, painful, scary situation. You know?
I agree with that. I agree. I think I have found, certainly with all of my clients and myself, and more connected to self than before, even with again, lots of painful changes. And actually, there was a song that a folk singer that I love, actually, to Suzzy Roach and her daughter Lucy Wainwright Roach, wrote a song called Swan Duck Song, I think. And I share it with some of my clients. It's about what Robin's saying. It's about bodies changing, recognizing mortality, but the freedom. Even in the great loss and pain, the freedom that comes with that connection to self, when you accept this is me, this is my body, this is who I am.
I think that's a great wrap up maybe for our session here. And I really want to thank you both for this opportunity. Wonderful to meet you, and very enlivening and thought-provoking. And so I thank you both for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio. It was such a delight to have this opportunity to interview Mark O'Connell and Robin Weigert. They've developed a strong relationship and clearly are committed to supporting one another professionally. Of course, Mark is the author of the very stimulating book, The Performing Art of Therapy, and he's also trained as an actor. Robin, while not a therapist, is a very successful actor who knows therapy from the inside out. This is because she comes from a very distinguished family of psychoanalysts and also has been on the receiving end of therapy as well. In our interview, both Mark and Robin made frequent references to her noted German psychoanalyst grandmother, Dr. Edith Weigert, MD, who managed to practice psychotherapy in Nazi Germany for a time. With the rise of Hitler, she left Germany and eventually came to this country, where in the late 30s she created the Washington School of Psychiatry. Several times during our interview, Mark and Robin referred to her grandmother's collection of writings, The Courage to Love, which was published by the Yale University Press in 1970. According to my guess, that book is very timely still. Mark O'Connell's book, The Performing Art of Therapy, was influenced by ongoing conversations with his friend Robin. As he notes in the interview, the word, quotes, performing, close quote, might suggest to some the following of some theoretical script. Actually, he's urging quite the opposite. His reference to psychotherapy as a, quotes, performing art, close quote, is meant to inspire therapists of whatever persuasion to realize that from a certain point of view, therapy is a dramatic performance, whether one intends that or not. He's suggesting that therapists who own that point of view can enliven their performance and the effectiveness of their work by taking instruction from the theater. This reminds me a bit of the sociologist Irving Goffman, whose book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, was very influential during my years in graduate school. His book set forth a dramaturgical analysis of human interactions. I think it sets a bit of a precedent, but Mark is breaking new ground with his focus on the psychotherapy relationship. For example, Mark writes, and I quote, "So to be clear, this book is meant as a companion to whatever training, philosophies, or techniques help you to organize what you already do as a therapist. Theories and methods help us to carve out the canals of our clinical treatments, but the art of using our idiosyncratic selves lets the water flow through. Just as actors balance the technical demands of their jobs with their unique instruments, therapists are also required to be in two places at once. We must hold the parameters of a clinical frame alongside the chaos of life, knowing alongside not knowing, not doing alongside doing, the temperature in the room alongside the temperature we aim to achieve," close quote. His observation has been that too many therapists have been boxed in by their belief that they have to live up to being, quotes, the expert. However, both Mark and Robin see the therapeutic relationship as co-created. Consider this passage from the book where Mark writes, and I quote, "I propose that approaching our work like actors, or better yet, like performing artists in our own right, can help us to use ourselves in all these ways and more. In my work as a therapist, the craft of acting provides tangible approaches to explore and play my unique instrument, the combination of my mind, face, body, emotions, voice, personality, energy, history, and imagination. But perhaps more importantly, it prepares me to get lost with my clients, to expand my sense of myself and them as we progress, and to return to a centered version of myself when the curtain drops and it's time to go home." Close quote. It's about jazz and improvisation, baby. If you're a therapist wishing to break out of the confinement of having to be, quotes, the expert, I think you will particularly relish the performing art of therapy, acting insights and techniques for clinicians by Mark O'Connell.
Hi, Dave. My name is Dr. Michael O'Canna, and I am a medical director for an adolescent psychiatric unit up here in British Columbia. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now, and in summary, I'm thrilled. You've collected interviews with some of the most exciting thinkers in neuroscience and mental health treatment today. I agree with the recent direction of your thinking. The age of Pax Medica is coming to a close, and a much more exciting era seems to be on the horizon. So I have decided to show my support, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. Just hit that support button and show Dave that you care. It feels good. Thanks, Dave, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Michael O'Kenna, for that recognition and endorsement. And thanks to all of our regular longtime donors. It warms my heart each time I'm looking at the honor roll on our site, and I'm reminded of your dedication to keep me going. So, time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks go out to today's guests, Mark O'Connell, New York City therapist, actor, and author of The Performing Art of Therapy, and actress Robin Weigert, who among her film credits is her role as the psychotherapist in the HBO series Big Little Lies. I highly recommend that series to all who can get it. Next week, I'll be speaking with Jonathan Sabag, founder and CEO of Journey Clinics, about their unique approach to working with therapists who wish to use ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.